This is Dylan FM, the podcast that goes deep into the work and world of Bob Dylan. You're listening to an extended episode, available exclusively to FM Plus or premium subscribers, with your host, Craig Danieloff.
Last night in Pleasantville, New York, which is about an hour north of New York City, at the Jacob Burns Theater, the Bob Dylan Center and director Steve Jenkins held a film event, showing rare clips from the Bob Dylan archives on a large movie screen in a beautiful room. The clips played were rare in that many don't circulate and none have been officially released, although some are from TV shows or events that were broadcast at one point or another. But a clip from the Supper Club, some live concert footage from 76 and 81, and some restored footage from the Don't Look Back era have never been seen publicly, except, of course, at the Bob Dylan Center. The bulk of the show, and perhaps the entire show, is what plays in the theater on the second floor at the Bob Dylan Center in Tulsa. That didn't make it any less fun to watch in a great room on a huge screen. After the show, Janet Maslin, the former film and literary critic for the New York Times, and evidently a huge Dylan fan, she even shouted out Dylan Twitter from the stage, held a nearly 30-minute Q&A with Bob Dylan Center director Stephen Jenkins. I just happened to record it, so this special bonus Dylan FM episode for premium subscribers only is your chance to listen in. It's a fun and interesting conversation. I wouldn't say it's indispensable, but it's enjoyable and interesting. If I weren't there, I'd want to hear it, so it seems like the perfect bonus from those of you who wish you could have been there and might want to listen in too. So here you go.
Congratulations on how brilliantly curated this hour is, because it tells the whole story of his career in some ways. You see from the venues he's in, from what he's wearing, from what he moves, all of it just adds up to a wonderful overview. And it has things in it that I, as a fanatic, have never seen, including, that's the best footage of Robbie Roberts that I ever saw. I didn't have any pretensions, and he was just the guy who Bob knew was going to be a he was needed as the guitarist for that band, but he wasn't a personality himself yet. That is spectacular.
Yeah, he was content to be in the shadows, literally, in some of that footage. But those, you know, blistering comes to mind in describing some of those guitar leads.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm glad you feel that the chronology and the selections work well, because it's, you know, there's a lot to choose from. And if this is a teaser, it acts as such. Terrific. Come to Tulsa, and you'll see some other stuff. But there's quite a bit in the archive, and it's, you know, it's the proverbial embarrassment of riches. But I think this delves into some of the key moments. Just the lovely Johnny Cat, you know, all of it.
In
really
that Australian
see the
documentary, he looks like Keith Richards. He's a different person each time. It's really like watching I'm Not There in some way.
Yeah.
And then the tribute to Johnny Cash, he's so light on his feet, he's so nimble. And then with Masked and Anonymous, something seems to have happened. I don't know what, but it's only 4 years later, at least I don't know. If the release dates are accurate to when things were made, but not much time has gone by, and suddenly he just seems like the spark has gone out.
Although, for me, that's in a way the most mesmerizing clip, called Irons Bound, you know, which was on Time Out of Mind from 1997, and then he revisits it for Masked and Anonymous, where he plays Jack Fate. So is that Dylan or is that Jack Fate we're seeing? So he could be embodying a certain character, but I do know, and you know, we could talk for a whole half hour about just the filmmaking.
You only have a half hour, I have a lot of questions.
Known and unknown behind these clips. But I know in that instance, Dylan said, the camera goes here, do not move it an iota. And
okay,
just knew.
So he was acting. Right.
Oh, absolutely. And was playing to the camera, I think, in that sense. No, that clip for me is, now I get to see these things a lot. And Cold Iron's Bound happens to play on a loop in one of our galleries. So I've seen him live, and I just cannot stop looking at him. As fantastic as that band is, Larry Campbell and thank you. Charlie Sexton, who now plays with Elvis and the Impostors, of course. You know, so to have those two guys on either side, and yet it's that look that Dylan gives, just occasionally to the camera, but mostly off to one side or another, that I just find transfixing.
Now, during the shows, the shows are very dramatic. The lighting is sensational. He doesn't come out from behind the piano. He doesn't touch a guitar. He plays the harmonica, I think, only once. And he seems very changed again. Do you think that this tour that it may really end next year, or do you have any idea?
From the get-go, it's been touted as 2021 through 2024. And that bracket of dates has stuck since Rough and Rowdy Ways tour was first advertised, with the great graphic treatment by Jeff Gans, who works closely with Dylan on that sort of thing. So we can expect dates into next year. I have no more intel than any, maybe some of you have more than I do, I don't know. But beyond 2024 and what he and the band have in mind remains to be seen. You know, Shadow Kingdom came as a surprise during the height of the pandemic, so I day-to-day hold out hope that there's a whole lot more to come.
I have a hard time believing he can stop.
And though he has, you know, physically slowed down a little bit on this tour, I would agree in his choice to be behind the piano, often with water bottles and in some instances boxes of cookies, blocking, you know, with some lights pointing out, not in, so it's even harder to see
than if you're lucky to sit up close.
But he's so present and he's so there, and his voice is in great form.
And it's such a good band. Yeah. I mean, the whole thing absolutely works.
And from night to night, you don't know what you'll get. A Grateful Dead cover, Van Morrison's Into the Mystic. If you were in San Sebastian?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's see what October and maybe November brings, and we'll get some more surprises.
Does he work with you at all? Have you dealt with him?
No. So here's the brief story of how this came to be. You know, in 2016, Dylan made it known to just really a select few folks that he had been keeping things. Well, what does that mean? What are these things? And it turns out these things are tens of thousands of items that he had been putting away in desk drawers, in cardboard boxes, with no real master plan as to what to do with them. But, you know, fortunately having the wherewithal to hold on to a Christmas card from John and Yoko. Curios like that, which are wonderful, but more importantly, and to me the most fascinating core of what we have at the center, are the handwritten manuscripts, the hundreds of songs, the 40 pages of lyrics to Dignity, you know, a song which he kept recording and kept cutting from albums. More and more of that sort of thing. And he held on to them, and he and his camp decided around 2016, well, it's time to do something with this. This does have cultural import. Where should it live? And, you know, a lot of places were clamoring for the material. The folks in Hibbing, Minnesota, as you might imagine, were very much hoping that he would return to his hometown, but that wasn't to be the case. Dylan came to Tulsa to have a look around. The same organization that runs the Bob Dylan Center, called American Song Archives, we also run the Woody Guthrie Center, which by that point had been open about 3 years. Guthrie, as you probably know, Dylan's formative influence, very first song he wrote, Song for Woody. So the fact that our organization had already established its bona fides as doing a very nice job, I must say, with the Guthrie Archive, I think tipped Tulsa in his favor.
All right. I didn't realize they were joined it.
They are, yes. So we're all under one umbrella organization called American Song Archives.
So when we all make our way to Tulsa, which I certainly am going to do, is it like going to Lourdes or is it like going to Old Can you actually see the, because the stuff, it really is very small. I've seen pictures of what the lyrics look like.
Sure.
And you really need to stand in front of them as opposed to what you have to do to see the Mona Lisa, which is kind of, you know, either get a private tour or or gay over the heads of other people.
Yeah, well, you can't. I'll tell you, it's not like going to Graceland. I thought that was one comparison you might make. And I like that you brought up the Mona Lisa, because what we want to avoid is that moment where you're traveling, and you get there, and you can't have a truly engaging experience because of the mass of people. We have a lot of people coming through. We're, I think, close to 50,000 visitors in our first year plus, and we're thrilled with the response. But we're living, it's great. You know, really,
who
people...
Who here has been to Digital, too? Wow.
Fantastic. And of course, I see some friends.
Who here would like to go?
And I see Birch. Good. All right, we'll charter a bus later tonight. Train would be more fitting. We're limiting the number of people who can come in at any one time precisely because I think the material deserves that close-knit engagement.
I'm so glad to hear that.
Yeah. And there's quite a bit to see firsthand, the actual manuscripts, instruments, photographs. A very interesting clip, another film, and maybe if I ever come back, I can bring this one among other stuff, of Dylan on the set of an Auto Predator film in Hawaii talking to John Wayne. This is one that was in his own collection. So imagine that conversation, or a photograph of Dylan, maybe you've seen, with James Baldwin in the civil rights dinner.
Is the John Wayne clip on his butt?
It is. Okay. Come take a look.
Here comes some real crazy questions. I was blessed with the same kind of hair that he has. It was very curly when I was younger. I'd wake up and it would just do what it was going to do, and that was bad hair and looked nice, so I never worried about it. And then as I got older, it straightened out, it just started in all directions, and we see him groomed in a couple of these clips where he's singing Hollis Brown, and also to the tribute for Johnny Cash. He's in TV makeup and somebody has done his hair. Yeah. But in general, do you think he just sort of rolled out of bed and that's who he was, or did he pay attention to how he looked?
I think there's been a facade of nonchalance that masks a real conscientiousness around the impression that he's making when he walks into a room, And I have a funny story that I'll share that I think sheds light on some of this. We have an exhibition at the center right now of early photographs of Dylan called "Becoming Bob Dylan," because he really wasn't quite Bob Dylan, this is back to 1961, taken by the photographer Ted Russell, who was a photojournalist for Life magazine, and he got a tip from a friend at Columbia Records, hey, go check out this guy, we've just signed him, his first record isn't even out yet, but we kind of think he's going to be something. Ted Russell goes to Gertie's Folk City in the Village and photographs Dylan before he was really Dylan. Then Dylan said, hey, I like you. Come over to my apartment and, let's just hang out. And so he took some really lovely intimate photos of Dylan along with Susie, his partner at the time, just hanging out at the apartment. Now, and you see an unguarded, almost baby-faced Dylan. The wonderful Woodstock-based folk singer Happy Tron. Happy came through the center a few months ago. And he said, we used to go to this apartment. We used to go to this apartment and have dinner with Bob and Susie. This is Happy and Jane Tron. We were still together all these years later. And they were coming over for dinner one night and, walking up to the apartment, and Dylan comes walking the other way, carrying a bag of groceries, getting ready for a little dinner party. And this is even then when, the consciousness apparently wasn't there and he wasn't aware of the camera. But as Happy Trump told me, Dylan kind of looked around and said to Happy, don't tell anyone you saw me carrying groceries. So it was just a small little anecdote, but I think even then there's this sense of, a persona. From the name change on. So the unkempt hair, whatever it might be, effortless cool, it takes a little work.
I love the fact that you sell inside Llewyn Davis in addition to a lot of his things, because, that's a pretty bold choice, but he's not in it, really, but he hovers over it, the whole thing.
Sure.
And does he give you any input about that kind of thing, what emerged you guys?
Right. So to finish your question, and I'll get to that specific. I mean, the answer to that is no. We sell things in the gift shop as we see fit. Certain things, there's some branded merch.
They're all over at my house.
Photographs that, of course, go to the photographer or the estate of the photographer to get permission to use those things. So Dylan said, all right, Tulsa it is. He likes what he calls the hum of the heartland. Mm-hmm. He did mention it's important to him we're on Native American land in Tulsa. The James Joyce Archive is at the University of Tulsa. There's just an abundance of historic and literary riches. Of course, the musical history of Tulsa, the so-called Tulsa Sound, the great Leon Russell and his church studio, which has now been reopened and beautifully restored. So Dylan, of course, is aware of all of this. And he said, Tulsa it is, the chagrin and amazement of all the other world capitals that were hankering to get this collection. But Dylan said, no, something is right here. That feels good. Something is happening here. Said, Tulsa it is. I give you my blessing. The boxes will arrive shortly. Don't call me. I'm not looking at the opening. I'm not shaking hands. This is not a surprise. So beyond agreeing that Tulsa would be indeed the permanent home of the archive, the center of Dylan activity in so many ways now, he has not been involved. He has not been to the center. He played in town at the Tulsa Theater, which is a 3-minute walk from us. Just before we opened, we were ready for him in case he wanted to come by. Nope. Went to the opening night of the Drillers, which is our minor league baseball team, and hung a pennant for the team on the piano at the night of the show. Didn't make mention of the fact that his life's work was the representative of his. And this is, it's a relief on one hand, because it's not like we have to bow and scrape and say, Mr. Dylan, is it okay if we want to do such and such? And it's given us freedom, and I think he's got the trust, and probably, again, the fact that he did see the Guthrie Center, which is very lovely and moving in its own right, if I can say so, probably gave him enough confidence that these guys seem to know what they're doing, let's just give them a shot at it.
Let me ask you, this is important about the reputational arc that he has gone through. There was a time when people who were really interested in him, like A.J. Weberman, who went through his car, were fanatics. And over time, suddenly every single thing he ever did has become important, to the point where it seems like there are almost too many versions of him, songs, and too many bootlegs, and too many, too much material surfacing. And we're at a moment now where everybody is so tuned into him that I think... the most recent album is now number one on the Billboard charts, maybe because of his tour or whatever, but he's suddenly selling records again, which is unimaginable at this point. So do you chronicle because his popularity in the 80s or 90s took kind of a dive, and then you could do a chart almost of how this works. Is that part of what you show?
Well, we're certainly looking at the chronology, and the great writer and Dylan essayist and scholar Sean Wilentz has broken up Dylan's life into what we call 9 eras, and we're representing those as best we can in a certain gallery space. We go deep into 6 songs, the writing, the recording, the producing, the performance, all kinds of other displays too, but sure, there's that chronology, all the albums are represented. There's acknowledgement that Dylan has, seemingly been unconcerned with holding on to fans. We know, of course, from the Born Again period, that he lost a lot of followers who were very confounded by the iconoclast that they held so dear, embracing a mainstream belief system and proselytizing on stage. What's great, though, about that is we can now go back and really focus on the music. And, there's amazing stuff on that trilogy of records, particularly Shot of Love, I think, and Slow Train Coming. So all of that's there, and the question of the audience, the question of the fan, comes into place. We have fan mail that was sent to Dylan in the 60s and 70s that he kept but never opened, but held on to, and so we painstakingly opened some of these letters, and it's an outpouring, as you can imagine, of folks across the world just wanting Bob to know what the work was meant to them. So it's very personal. I think everyone who comes into the center has a different point of entry into the work and into the life and the music. We want to honor all of that. We want to really, you know, Dylan paraphrasing Walt Whitman on Rough and Rowdy Ways, I contain multitudes. And we just want to be true to that spirit of expansiveness. It was never a, oh, now we've got your stuff that you saved, we've got you figured out. I mean, what's the fun in that, first of all?
Nobody hasn't figured out.
No, of course not. It's that much more confounding in a way. The more you look at it, you can just go deep into the layers.
This is just an aside, but do you think Timothy Chalamet can play him?
He's a talented guy, you know. It'll be interesting to see what he does. I can say this, that the prop master for the film that Chalamet is going to star in spent some time at the center looking at parchment, ink, you know, really wanting to get those details just right. So they're certainly doing their due diligence. We'll have to see what happens with the strike that is postponed along with every other project. But, you know, it'll be interesting.
Yeah, I really hope it gets made. I hope that everybody involved is very talented and they can age out of it if it doesn't happen soon.
Yeah.
All right, this is a rough one. I always thought I never want to see his picture on a page of the New York Times. I just don't want to see that. And then he won the Nobel Prize, and that was great. So that was okay. But someday he's going to be on the front page of the New York Times. Do you have a plan for what to do?
Well, the way that fans, you know, the hardcore Dylanologists, more casual fans, folks just curious about what a new attraction is in Tulsa, Oklahoma, have come in, and we know the depth of feeling that people bring to Dylan, that I'm sure all of us in our own ways have, you know, spent our lifetimes tracking in different ways. You know, should Dylan end up on the front page for that reason? You know, we certainly anticipate people wanting to flock to the place that's kind of the closest to him without him being there, which is so much of his actual artistic possession and creative process as he saved it and is now we're able to display it. So I imagine there will be a sort of coming together of fans. And it's, you know, something we talk about in hushed terms at the end of the day sometimes.
I
the what ifs and the
when. But you must have plans for all kinds of things.
Yeah, you know, I think, sure, it's something we think about, but there's so much to do right here and now.
Yeah.
We have Chris Hillman coming in a few weeks. Bernie Taupin is coming to talk about his new book. John Waters is coming as Bob Dylan Center Presents.
Thank you for putting us on your homepage today, by the way. I thought I'd die.
You know, it's, all these things are exciting, again, because the focus is really the creative process. Yeah. Looking at Dylan as an exemplar of that, obviously an extraordinary one, but that rubric allows us to bring in the work of many other artists, musicians, filmmakers, writers, and on and on.
You will be shaping his legacy in the biggest sense. But I think a lot of us who really care about him are trying to pass this on to our children and grandchildren. And if you have little grandchildren, I highly recommend playing Subterranean Homesick Blues and jumping on the bed with them. My mom was only two. She knew Bob and Susie from the cover of Free Will. And we would always jump on the bed. Where can you imagine how he'll be thought of 50 years from now? Or how to pass this on to younger people who are so much more critical in some ways than we were. We just accepted anything we did. And I'm a person who liked Bob Dylan, Pootie Cat, and said so. But you know, for some of us, he can do no wrong. For others, they're good to take away. So how do you see your role in shaping the way things?
you know, we want to present the material again in its multiplicity, Dylan in his multiplicity, and just help create dialogue. You know, again, we don't. It's interesting that question of legacy and how the center might help shape it. I mean, I think we're really just a forum for discussion and a place of coming together for good-natured debate or fierce argument, as it might be sometimes. What we're keen on doing, though, is a lot of education. And so we've had, this year alone, you know, thousands of students from the Tulsa Public School System come in. Now, they're thrilled. They're out of the classroom. They're on a field trip. We've got interactive screens. We've got buttons you can push. We have a recording studio experience, magnets with words from Dylan's songs that you can rearrange on the board, all kinds of interactive activities that children are really gravitating toward. But every once in a while, I'll see that kid who maybe was me as a precocious, you know, fourth grader or whatever it might have been, and I can just see that there's a real impact being made. And maybe that's our next singer-songwriter or our next Dylan scholar.
Well, you sponsor events by other people singing your song, so younger people.
Certainly,
that's,
yes.
That's a big part of it.
We have songwriting workshops. We do that at Guthrie Center as well. And I think the question of what might this body of work look like in 50 years, and we'll still be interested, I think Guthrie is a great example. I mean, of course, he hasn't been here since 1967, but I think that the impact of that work, the prescience of Guthrie's vision, the relevance, we have a, just as an aside, at the Guthrie Center is a lyric written by Woody Guthrie, called Old Man Trump. Trump Senior, who's a slumlord, surprise, surprise. Mike Guthrie, you know, who's to say for sure, right? This is our Shakespeare, and this body of work will endure, and I want to believe that Tulsa will always be a center and a focal point. Scholars and academics can come in and access the full archive, and in fact, books, I know there's a lot out there, but there's more to come, have already emerged that are making use of the materials that previously nobody knew existed. So many more stories to tell.
What about the 30th anniversary concert? That is one of the best things I've ever seen. And there's it needs restoring. They cut it like a music video.
Sure.
And it's awful. It just jumps around and all this backstage stuff. Watching it in real time was a totally different experience. Do you have that? And is it something you might work on?
Yeah, I love that version of My Back Pages.
You didn't know who was going to step forward next. And then that's why you hear the screams of excitement, because we didn't know.
Sure.
The way it cuts around, you know exactly who's going to, you know, what the order's going to do.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a long wish list that we are trying to chip away at.
Oh,
and,
please.
And you saw with the restored footage where we've been able to clean up some of this. We wanted to start with that body of work. The tour of the Heartbreakers that Julian Armstrong did such a beautiful version of filming. There's a larger story to tell around that footage. There's a whole reconstruction of Newport 65 that I think will put to rest some rumors and then start some new myths about that axe that supposedly PC here was looking for. So there's a lot there, and it's really just a question of, you know, what are we tackling first? What can we get to? Do we have the funds to do the restoration that we want? But we'll give us a little time. We'll get there.
All right. But anyway, that's a huge story. That's one of the best things I've ever seen.
That's a good one.
But the best concerts I ever saw were the Rolling Thunder tour. Mm. I followed them around the wing, and I just want to end this with a story. I know it's not about me, but I followed them. I knew I had followed them around New England. They just, you know, I never saw anything like that before or since. And I knew I wrote about it, but I didn't remember any of the details. And when Rolling Thunder came out, Scorsese's version of it, which I love, and it's one of my go-to comfort films, I wanted my kids to see it so badly. And I tried everything, including buying his bourbon, Bob Dylan bourbon, and trying to bribe him with that. And they just wouldn't do it. And I have two sons and two daughters-in-law. And Christmas Day comes along, and they have these, first of all, one of them has found the article. It appeared in a magazine called New Times that existed in the 70s. And I was a music columnist. Frank Rich was a movie critic. It had a wonderful bunch of people working for it. It did sensational reporting. It only lasted a few years. But so I actually had written about it. And in fact, it's the most accurate thing I ever wrote, all of it, including what it's like to see it again and realize how planned every single thing is. It's not as spontaneous as it looks. But they had that, and then they made up T-shirts. And on the front, it had a picture of him, and it had apropos of what I do. Don't criticize what you don't understand. And on the back, it said, it was Christmas Day of that year, it said, by invitation only, special screening. Janet screening. And they all sat down and watched. Bit by bit, we do what we can to make sure that but nobody's doing more to bring you. So thank you so much.
Thanks for listening.